So welcome back, everyone, to Costavino in Pittsburgh. Fourth lecture on his engineering, structural engineering, and his material innovations, his building science. Costavino benefited from arriving in America at the start of the Renaissance in architecture, as we saw last week, inspired by the Beaux-Arts movement, and more importantly, fueled by the industrialists, their newfound wealth that could afford to build these great monumental structures. Today, as I mentioned, we're going to look at his innovations that he had structurally using these tiles, as well as this building science that's been right at the turn of the century starting to really take some steam, pushing architecture in a new direction towards material sciences. And we'll see a little bit of that here today, as well as next week in our final lecture. So if you recall back to our earlier lecture on the Boston Public Library, in 1885, the structural clay tile vaults that Rafael Costavino was introducing to the United States through the public library was under construction, and he delivered during that period. He delivered a lecture at MIT to the Society of the Arts, which was subsequently published later. And in addition to that lecture, he also built an example vault, similar to what we're seeing here. You can see it's kind of four-sided, but he also is demonstrating down here layers of tiles to create a single span arch around the perimeter on the four sides, in addition to the dome vault in the center. And this was to illustrate these points on what he referred to as cohesive construction, as it is applied to the timbrel vault. And so this this concept is taking bricks, as we're seeing here down below, laying them flat on a first layer through the vault, and then subsequently laying subsequent layers on top, changing the orientation of the bricks to have have the joints staggered, and as well as adhering between the layers with Portland cement as an adhesive. And this this generally would be 2 to 3 layers typically on a vault, and that 3 layers really kind of most common, because that first layer would be, again, initial layer that would be joined at the joints with a plaster of Paris, which is a much faster setting plaster, would set up in 15 minutes or so, that would enable these bricks to kind of hold their position as you continue to apply more bricks to the vault. And then this Portland cement, which would be much stronger from a construction standpoint, would then be applied on the top face of the first layer. And then the second layer would be laid into it. So that really creates the lamination, and that the binding between the brick layers is really where the strength comes from. And so with 3 layers, you would have the second layer go on top, and then you'd have a third layer that would also, again, reorientate the joints. So that way they would be, again, staggered to create almost like a weave, so that the bricks almost become woven together. And so then you would have end up with two layers of this mortar set to create not just one kind of single layer of strength, but a double. So that way, again, it's kind of just redundancy. And so between these bricks that are typically about an inch thick in the mortar set, between them about a half inch, that ends up with 3 layers, ends up being roughly about 4 inches thick, a relatively thin section. This is in contrast to a typical stone vault we're seeing up here above, where the stones are generally laid in dry, and they're stacked and would be unsupported, or would be supported by a temporary shoring below, usually made of wood, but that shoring would be supporting the stones until the top keystone piece is placed in which case then all of the weight of the one half of the vault is leaning against that keystone and supported from the other side by the other half of the vault. And so really all of that compressive weight of the stone is pinching on that keystone at the top. All of that, of course, resisted from being thrust, pushed upward by a load placed on top of it from above. This type of structure, stone, is strictly a compressive type construction. This Catalan style thin vaulting is also working in compression, but it's also this adhesion between the layers that Guastavino is really selling to his builders, developers, and architects here in the States, explaining the advantages of this Portland cement. You'll also see here a couple details. This kind of illustrates how these are fingered together. If you can imagine this being the first layer of tile, and he would apply some of this plaster of Paris to the edges of the brick, slotting the bricks in. In which case, if he has this kind of straight pattern that we're seeing here, like this, then this tile that's being placed in, half that tile ends up getting supported on three sides. It gets pinched into that place, and that's really what enables it to create that adhesion that holds it in place and to continue to finger these bricks out. Similarly, if he's laying it in more of a herringbone type fashion, it would be just the two sides then that's supporting it as it fingers out, as opposed to on the three. So you can see why initially the early vaults that we see in his work back in Spain, as well as some of the early vaults that we see in the States, have this kind of linear pattern, as opposed to the herringbone pattern that we're more familiar with, that's more his signature, that we're going to see later today as well as next week. But this linear straight pattern enables it to be a little bit stronger, a little bit as that initial plaster of Paris is setting up, because it's being held in place on three sides and kind of pinched it back into here, as opposed to just the two.
When did he get the laborers to do this?
So he would kind of take them from the local masonry laborers that are working here and take them on. He would kind of show them his system and really kind of try to attract the best laborers he could find, kind of with the promise that he would teach them on his system, kind of in exchange for them, staying with him. And a lot of that also goes back to this idea of patents, because he did have, once you learn the technique, it's not like the technique is overly complicated. You could certainly go out and become his competition and start to kind of offer the same type thing. But what Guastavino had was, one, he had years of experience, which plays a lot into it, but he also recognized very quickly in the States this patenting concept, where he could prevent other contractors from supplying this type of technique if he holds his patents, where he's the only one that can do this. And we're going to see that a lot today here. We're going to see actually several of his patents that he developed for the structural engineering, as well as some of also the building science innovations that he made as he went along. So, do you have another question?
Yeah, C and D appear to be both a running bond. Neither one is a herringbone, where the bricks are right angles.
That's right.
Is a herringbone advantageous compared to a running bond?
No, so this type of running bond, where you're just catching two sides, obviously you could place this piece in and create the same type thing where you have a cavity and then place this one in.
But if they're running them kind of the way it's illustrated here, where they just kind of lay them like this and then another row like this, you're right, that's not a herringbone pattern, which would kind of alternate like this as you go.
Yeah.
But it's still, the herringbone, like this type of bond, only has the two sides that you adhere to it. So even if you were to lay like this next one in a herringbone, you're still only adhering two sides of that. So it, neither one has, you know, they're pretty much equally advantageous. This being far more advantageous as far as laying. And that's, again, this just goes back to the sequencing, the way that it's laid in.
Great question. I'll read a quote here from his lecture that he gave in 1889 at the Society of the Arts at MIT. He said, "The flat brick was used with the idea of decreasing the number of pieces, closing the space with the least possible joints, thus to give more strength and cohesion to the arch. They placed four rows, one on top of each another, breaking the joints, constituting through this medium an arch without joints." So it was woven rather than stacked that we're seeing like the stone. There's a single layer. The multiple layers where the joints are staggered creates almost this woven pattern. Interestingly enough, back in Spain, the region that he came from around Barcelona, the outlying mountains range that surrounds that region had quite a few natural grottos that would occur. And actually, if you recall back from Antonio Gaudi, any of you took that class with me, these grottos were of great interest to Gaudi as well as even Guastavino. Many of them, they would erect mini shrines or small little places to kind of reverence the various figures and their religious beliefs. But there was a comment that was made at one point by Guastavino referring to these grottos, which was kind of within their psyche as a very young age. As you can imagine, kids running around through these caves and playing. But he said that within this great specimen of nature's architecture, the thought entered my mind while in this immense room that all of this colossal space was covered by a single piece forming a solid mass of walls, foundation, and roof, all being made particles set one over the other as nature has laid them. This grotto is really a colossal specimen of cohesive construction. And so this was kind of a narrative that he would sell, again, to these developers and these architects here in the States, of this concept of cohesive construction. And if you can imagine the way that a cave is created is the water leaching down through the stone creates these deposits on the surface. And these deposits are very small, minuscule deposits that then harden as it dries and creates the surface that we're seeing. And it's this concept of miniaturizing these particles into a cohesive whole that creates this cohesive surface. And if you, similar to the this last slide that we looked at, part of the strategy is to work these smaller bricks as opposed to a larger piece of stone. By miniaturizing the units, it moves it towards the direction of becoming more of a cohesive whole. If you can imagine these bricks becoming even smaller, smaller, smaller to the size of these particles that you would find in a cave, then really the adhesion between them, this cement or this mortar, becomes really the key component, and the bricks themselves become more of like an aggregate that you would find in a concrete that we're finding here today. This being kind of like a precursor almost to the concrete construction that we have in modern day times, where it's primarily the concrete, the Portland, that is the binding strength, and the aggregate is in smaller quantity placed inside of it. And so this is almost kind of a stepping stone between this form, and then the later day concrete. One also thing that of note interest in this quote, he says, a single piece forming a solid mass of walls, foundation, and roof.
And so this goes back, if you recall back from our very first lecture, when I was talking about this kind of definition in architecture between walls and roof really being kind of the two critical elements that you find in architecture through the history of time. And here we find this wall that kind of morphs into the roof ceiling overhead, almost indistinguishable between the two. Where does the wall end and where does the roof begin when you have this organic shape or organic solid? And much of the architecture you see today, in today's times, is trying to move in this direction, create this organic form where the lines between roof and wall are blurred. And this is something that Guastavino is picking up on back in Spain in the 1800s, recognizing that this natural architecture that Mother Nature is creating is moving in the same direction. So again, this cohesive construction is this concept. He's stating like that the weight load of these pieces of tiles, if they're small enough proportionately to the strength of the adhesive, the mortar, binding them together, then the system acts as this cohesive monolith as a whole, much like these natural grottos. Similarly, not just this adhesion that we're talking about, but also critical to these structures is the profile, the shape of this arc. And here in this illustration, you can see if you take a piece of paper in hand and you just hold it in hand, the paper is very limp, is very soft. But if you just apply a slight curvature to it, you can create some rigidity to the paper across it to where you create this cantilevering effect. And this concept of using this profile or this curvature creates a certain amount of tension within the structure. So now we're dealing with not just compressive forces, but we're adding some tension to it. And that really is where the strategy of this shallow dome vault comes into play. Even more to the point, he had a term, this timbrel term, that he would use in reference to his work. And this timbrel term goes back to a reference that he was trying to make to music, to a drum. And much the same way a drum is the structure of it is in tension, to the point where that tension is what creates a resonance when you tap on the drum. And in a similar note, these very thin, shallow vaults that they would create out of this masonry material, because it had this profile, would have a similar kind of tone to it when you would tap on it that you would find in a drum form, which is where he kind of coined it as this timbrel vault. And so here we're seeing a cross section, again, three layers, which is pretty typical of these vaults. You can see up the top here, he's got two layers that are flat across the top, and this is creating a flat floor level, and so he's supporting this floor structurally, spanning between this point and that point with this arch, a very shallow arch. And again, the shallow profile is necessary. You can create a much more of a Roman type arch that would be much taller, but then it would you couldn't squeeze as many floors in a given height. And so this shallower vault had a major advantage in trying to pack more floors in a multi-floor structure. But you can also see here some of the details of the way that they supported this. In this case, on the left-hand side, it could be hollow and just have these verticals that are supported off the arch up to support the horizontal coming across. Or other times it would be filled with like a material or even waste. Scrap material from the job site to kind of fill those voids. But this is really the key point of this system, is that through this very narrow profile, the laminations of the layers, this structure ends up acting more as a beam, like a horizontal beam. If you could imagine replacing this with just a single beam horizontal. Structurally, it's acting in the same way as opposed to a masonry vault where you have this compressive strength that's being transferred down around the printer. Because of the laminations, it's almost as if you could pick this piece up as a monolithic piece and then place it. And so it's this horizontal aspect that is really defining this or differentiating this from the traditional masonry structure. He went on to say in this lecture, in some cases, the timbrel vaults were used as a ceiling and floor, having two or three thicknesses of tile with plaster, and the haunches were filled with pottery. This pottery was leveled off with rubbish and mortar, finishing with the floor tiles above, which is what we're seeing here. So in 1908, he worked on Dottery Hall here on CMU's campus. And this is a drawing from Hornbostel for the design of the structure. And I wanted to point out here this drawing, interestingly enough, this line here. So this line, they're drawing this profile for the ground plane. As we're all familiar with here, Pittsburgh, the slopes and the hills. But we also see this other line that's drawn on here, which follows down this way, which is noted in here as the a tracing of the grade as it currently exists. And you can see him X-ing out a few windows where the grade is here. I guess one point the decision was made not to change the grade to a steeper slope and create this volume. Also up here in the center, this is the a bridge structure we're seeing in cross section that we're going to take a look at here in this example. There's a little bit closer up view of that grade change, but also just the structure of the building, stepping it down onto these piles at each point. You can see rather than a continuous footing that runs the length of the building, because of the fact that the ground steps, it's much easier to kind of step it down as almost like these feet finding level ground. And so from these piles, you would have a supporting structure coming up through, sitting on these piles, and therefore the need to span between each one of these steps. And that's where we see Guastavino's vaults coming into play to create the span between them and the subsequent floors above them. Here you can see the cross section through this bridge that we saw here. Again, the drawing's actually called out as Guastavino, pointing to his arch, the vault here that supports the floor above it for this bridge passage, as well as also called out here on the arch above for the ceiling. Also of note that the roof structure is actually not made of the tile, but it's made of a steel. And then here you can see the elevation from the exterior of the vault. And so the vault is actually vaulting both in length as well as in cross section. So it's creating actually a true dome with the four low points at the four corners. And again, those corners are kind of the key points. Being a low point, you start in the corners, you kind of work your way out as you lay these bricks down in series. Just one other thing, side note, just point out the detailing of the drawing. Quite amazing. It's almost a work of art in itself as far as the ornamentation and even just showing the hatching of the bricks through it. I certainly don't draw like that anymore on buildings. There's a wide shot of it. Even to the point where they went in to show the terracotta tiles on the roof. Each one of those, and then the actual building, which I'm sure we're familiar with here. And then from the underside, you can see his signature herringbone. And this was in 1908, 1909, one of the first vaults that he did here in Pittsburgh. Similarly, we have from 1914, just a few years later, the William Penn Hotel of downtown. You can see
Again, a bridge structure that's spanning between wings of the building. You can see the vault arch down below. And then what's interesting about this drawing is that this is the exterior elevation of the vault, but through this, he's cutting through, here he's cutting through a plan. He's overlaying a floor plan on this. So you can see the column in plan here that's running up vertically, as well as the thickness of the wall. He's cutting it through this window. So you can see the window in plan, how the jamb relates to the exterior wall, cutting through. And then he also has it doing a similar thing where you're cutting a section through the building that relates back to the elevation. And again, all of these lines kind of align. So you can see at each level, at the arch, for example, where the sections cut through the center, you can see here where the arch is drawn and comes a much shallower arch in section than it is in the longitudinal section. But you can see where it comes to the center here, to the side, is being supported. Again, key note here is you see this steel I-beam at the point here. And so this span at this level is being supported by a piece of steel that's running from one end to the other. And so this wall, the exterior wall that we're seeing here in elevation, is all supported by this steel structurally. The only thing that Guastavino is providing with his arch is to support the actual floor above it. And so the floor is supported by Guastavino's arch that comes back in and ties into the steel and transfers all that load to this steel beam. Similarly, if you go up one floor, this is on the 16th floor, to the 17th floor, you can see here a notation where they're not even using Guastavino's arch on the interior to support this 17th floor. This is being poured in concrete, so it's a reinforced concrete slab. That again ties back into a steel beam, so each floor has a repetition of these steel beams going up. But in this case, they're just using Guastavino for this initial lower 16th floor. There's a little bit closer detail of it. And you can see, again, the cross-section cut in here. It's even noted on the drawings, Guastavino arch to support floor, and then the 16th floor level. And then this would tie down into the point, showing how all of this ties into the steel beam, and then also all of the terracotta work that's happening on the exterior that's applied to it through a mortar set. And then here's a image of the exterior. And you can see why his work was just limited to that lower floor, because all this was intended to be exposed visually at interest, again, the herringbone pattern, aesthetically to the other side, the interior, the ceiling of the 16th floor, probably not used as much or open visual as much, so the money wasn't spent to have him to lay that. Closer up view here.
Who was the architect?
This was Benno Jansen. And this was in 1914. So then in 1890, at the Boston Public Library, we turn here, this is a photograph of the library, and again, we see the tiles laid in a linear fashion for the arches there. And a closer up detail, here's a copy from his patent from 1891, where he's introducing this concept of interlocking tiles. So this first layer that he's laying, he's rather than having a square edge on his tile, he's creating a little bit of a notch. So as you can imagine, this tile would be laid in, it creates a little bit of a bed for this next tile to kind of fit into and sit upon to create a little bit more support as this plaster of Paris is setting up. And so he's kind of continuing that across there. A couple of years later, in 1895, he takes it even further. You actually see here a photograph on the edge where you can see this notch on the edge of his tiles. So you can actually see how he laid this up, in this case, three layers. But then he also takes it further to create this tile where it's got a bevel as opposed to a notch. In this case, he's using that bevel. Here he's got the arch, but also when he has a straight condition, that earlier slide we saw where the top floor is level and he's laying tiles for that, He can lay the bevel and support it similarly as you have this tile and you lay the next one in. And of course, obviously a beveled edge is a lot easier to manufacture than one with a notch. And so just, again, just an efficiency detail. But two examples of his patents to develop not only just the technique, but also getting into the manufacturing of these tiles. So here we arrive here at the Calvary Episcopal Church here in Pittsburgh by Ralph Cram. And this is in 1906. This is one of his first structures here in Pittsburgh, first vaults. In fact, we're seeing here on the main nave, you can see is a flat ceiling, wood panels supported by a non-masonry structure above, and also the side aisles, again, also sloped ceilings. But over on the this portion here at the front of the structure, you can see the vaults coming in through. A little bit closer up. And again, the tiles laid in a straight pattern with these ribs. Going back to our very first lecture back in Spain, where the ribs were made of stone, and the tile was an infill between the ribs. This was the first rib structure that he did in Pittsburgh here in 1906. A little bit closer detail here, you can see the work. This was so early that his kind of stereotypical kind of mortar set is starting to ferret out. You can see kind of the shadow line on the mortar where the mortar extends beyond the face of the brick. So it creates this kind of dramatic shadow line, but it's not as clean and refined as what his later tile will be. So at this point, I think this was just kind of more of a technique that he later realized could become really a signature visual kind of aesthetic that he cleaned up and tightened up. We'll see coming up here next week. But interestingly enough, you look at the drawings, again, he's calling out, in this case, Guastavino's ribs in vaulting. So he's not just supplying the vaults between them, as far as the ribs being traditionally in stone, he's actually supplying the ribs in tile as well. So he's got tiled ribs and tiled brick between the ribs. Even though the ribs are shaped in such a way to have the look of a stone rib. So these would be pieces that would be cast here in tile to have that look of stone. And with this structure, we actually have the specification, the written specification. So when a building is created, in addition to the drawings that would show you visually how to construct this building, there'd be a written form. And this would be broken up into different sections, like the excavation, the foundations, the stonework, the brickwork, each carpentry work, the roofing. Each one of these sections would be written out at length, describing all of the details. So for example, here the mortar says, all mortar for laying up the brickwork, except as otherwise specified, shall be as follows. And so one barrel of Portland cement, 3 barrels of sand, 2 of lined putty, and the lime is to be slacked and stacked at least a week before using. All mortar must be used immediately after mixing. And so they're here, the ingredients and the proportions of all these mixtures is being specified by the architect for the masons to use in their brickwork or in their masonry work.
Just a side color commentary. When we went there, the patrons of that church were notable. Frick being one.
Right. Thank you.
And his contemporaries.
So further down in the specifications, they actually call out Guastavino vaulting. So here is a case where, again, because it's this patented system, it's not like it's a spec that's being put out to bid for contractors to gain the work of the vaults. They're basically saying, The vaults will be provided by Guastavino. And so, even more to the point, because it's not being sent out to bid, they're specifying here the different vaults within the structure, how much will be paid for each vault. But just to note, the following portions of the church will have unglazed, finished, pressed tile arch construction. Vaulted ceilings with molded ribs of the same material, about 6 by 8 inches, exposed dimensions. So the look is being specified very specifically by the architect. In this case, we're seeing. Also to note that here says the above amounts include the scaffolding for setting the work. And so here's where, because the contractor, Guastavino, has to provide the scaffolding within his price, the advantage of being able to lay this stuff with minimal scaffolding is obviously less cost taken out of his money to increase his profit margin. Further down in the spec section on fireproofing, interestingly enough, it said the following floors and roofs are to be entirely constructed of the CON system of hollow tile and reinforced concrete or equal approved by the architect. So here, and they're also specifying on the drawings, each of these places, the entire floor of the church, the gallery floor of the church, all of these are to be fireproof assemblies. So that way if a fire breaks out on the ground floor, it can't spread through each floor to the upper floors because of this fireproof system. In much the same way that Guastavino marked his vaults as this Guastavino system, cohesive construction, here's a gentleman by the name of Kahn that's marketing and patenting, his system of fireproofing for these various structures. And in fact, you can see on the drawing here, a section through the front narthex. It's actually called out fire roof floor. And down here also, each one of these locations, as well as here, Guastavino's ribs and vaulting, called out in the side aisles. And then some examples of this vault and the ribs that Guastavino provided. Again, unglazed tiles, pressed, which is just a type of technique as far as the tile itself. And then interestingly enough, this other stonework that we're seeing around here, which is cut stone, much more labor intensive as opposed to a pressed brick that's in a mold, where they can turn these out in much greater quantity, quicker. Each one of these is you can't mold a piece of stone, so it has to be hand cut by a mason. And so these stone carvings, the architect would provide these trace papers, and this is this reproduction here on this. Here is roughly about the size of this trace, the original. And they would trace these out, and this is showing here, you can see this stone pattern from that elevation we just saw here in this window. And so the architect would draw these out full scale to the actual stone. So that way the stonemason could use these drawings to measure from as they're chiseling away their stone. This would be done for pretty much every detail piece in the structure. Here we're seeing an example of the candle holder made of metal, and how the candle would slot into this metal piece that's being made, how the metal piece would then slot into the base support here, the fitting that would be placed down into with anchors into the stone. So that way these candle holders would be almost seamlessly just kind of attached to the surface of the stone. But this, even the here, brass candle sockets, this brass work is full scale drawing, so that way the metal worker that's creating these things can take measurements off this. Here's an example of the door knocker at the front door. And then so we come to Guastavino's. This is number 49 of couple hundred of these tracings throughout the entire building, but you can see his drawing much simpler because they're just trying to articulate
this rib that he's creating that then his tile vault will notch into. And so this is a full scale size drawing of the rib, and so that way he can take these measurements directly off this as he's casting and creating his ribs. Going down to the lower structure, down below the main level here, we can see again drawings calling out for his vaulting inside. And then down below, some photographs of these vaults. This being the vaults that support the main floor above, this is kind of really the workhorse of the vaults within the structure. You notice that because it's a space that's more of a functional, mechanical space, where the utility equipment is placed, these vaults are less important from an aesthetic perspective. And so the ribs themselves are being laid up to just the standard square brick that he's using for the field and in the vaults he's using for the ribs themselves. Again, just to use the standard product to make it much more efficient, not having to create a custom piece for the ribbing. You can see how the arches come together. You can see the multiple layers, again, of the lay the arch, lay the rib, and then lay the vault between the ribs and the arch as a sequence. And you can also see in some cases, depending on how much load is being brought in and concentrated, you can see multiple layers being applied. Again, just as a function of, as you work your way down to the lowest point, these loads continue to compound. So responding to that by adding additional layers as needed. And then another vault within the same, this is out in the front near the narthex, and here we see a different type of finish, a glazed finish that is also modeled with different colors. And he's also, interestingly enough, he's doing almost kind of like a hidden rib detail. He's laying the bricks on end, going up inside the vault and laying the vaults to it. So you just have this single flat kind of edge detail. Very unusual type vault that we don't see too much in Pittsburgh. If you call back from last week, where a lot of the vaults are more Gothic in style. But this church, despite being one of his first examples of work in Pittsburgh, has quite a variety of brick as well as technique and design throughout just this single structure. To some degree, with only being two of these vaults, smaller vaults within the front of the church, could be a scenario where even though, as we saw in the specification, the architect was calling for just the unglazed brick press, he might have talked the contractor or even the architect into allowing him to show a little bit more of his wares of a more stylized brick. Since it's a smaller quantity, the cost wouldn't be that much of a cost to him if he was going to get paid the same amount as an unglazed brick. But it's an opportunity, much like we saw at the Boston Library, where he's doing variety of different tiles, variety of different patterns, colors, glazes, throughout the library, just kind of almost like a catalog of all of the things he can offer. Here he sees one of his first structures in Pittsburgh, an opportunity to show off a couple different possibilities, so that way as his people, like Fricks, are using this structure, they see this and they recognize, oh wow, he could do more than just this unglazed brick. He could do something that's a little bit more polished aesthetically and visually. So with that, I'm going to take a 5-minute break, and we'll resume here at about 4:05.
The mortar, like it was on some of them, like the square.
Right. Yeah, that's
special forms or tools for that?
Tool. They've got a they'll have a trowel that's got like a little square notch in it that they'll kind of drag across it type thing.
Are you familiar with the vaulting at Grand Central Station?
Yes.
And who did that?
That's his.
Oh, that is his?
Yes.
By the Oyster Bar?
Yep.
Because for years, while I grew up outside there, and you know, you stand in the corner, one counter, and whisper.
Right.
And it travels across to the other.
That's right, yeah. You can get a similar effect here over in Baker and Porter.
You do the same thing, the whispering?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Actually, if you go up to the top floor of Baker, at the top of the stairs, which we'll see in the second half here, where the ceiling has got a dome like that, you can kind of stand in the corners and get the same effect. And then continue down the hall towards Porter, at the very end of the hall, and you kind of turn left, where his vaults kind of continue down, which we'll see next week.
Okay.
You can do a similar thing there.
Similar whisper.
I actually have some pictures here of the of the Oyster Bar here. I can show you. Because I don't have that in the lecture here today, but
I worked on campus for 27 years, and I can't believe all I missed.
Oh, yeah, I don't know Baker Hall.
I mean, he looks at ceilings all that much, you know.
So it's his the work right outside the Oyster Bar is some of his most famous vaults. And it's primarily just because at that point, which we'll see a little bit next week, he's getting into creating these custom tiles that are really ornamental, and also custom glazes to create this really color variation. And
Well, thank you. I never realized he did that.
Oh, yeah.
All the time I spent whispering.
Well, that's exactly. I mean, that's what's really remarkable about Guastavino is that his work is all over the country in some of the most major landmark places. If you see a shallow vault that's got a herringbone pattern, there's a pretty good chance that that's his work. Let me see here.
Do patents expire like copyrights do?
They do, yeah. So I don't think we've reached that point, because I believe most of them are kind of generally, I think they're roughly 100 years.
Yeah, but nobody's doing this.
No.
It's not for that reason, I don't think.
There's the Oyster Bar.
Yeah, so you can see the colors. Here he's the grooves, he's creating this spiral effect. It's just stylized, but each one of these little moldings here, he's making the little rosettes, the little inset pieces here. All of these are custom made pieces. Again, you know, clay being something that, you know, is molded. You can, once you create the mold, which takes some time, you can then, you know, make quite a few of them pretty quickly. But yeah, it's as you can see, it's pretty remarkable visually.
Did he do the tile that's up around the buildings on campus here?
Oh yes, tile? And we'll see those next week.
I mean, up next to the roof line.
That's right. Yeah, on the exterior as well as the interior. We'll kind of save those for the last lecture, but he did all of that on campus. This is what?
South Side?
Grand Central Station. This is Grand Central Station in New York, yes. The Oyster Bar, which is down in the
Oyster Bar.
Oh, no. Yeah, I don't think he had anything to do with that one. So we'll get back into it here. In 1893, with the Central Congregational Church that we're seeing here on the left, if you recall back from last week, this was when he was giving his lecture in 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair that we talked about last week. This was one of the buildings that was at the time under construction that he was working on during that lecture. And this is obviously a picture of it finished. You can see the tile work.
But significantly, this dome is what's referred to as a pendentive dome, where the main circular dome in the center is supported on four sides by the cross-section of arches, vaults, or even a side dome coming in on the four sides that cut into that section to where all of this weight that's supported here comes down literally to a point, four points in the corners.
What's it called?
Pendentive, P-E-N-D-E-N-T-I-V-E, pendentive. And we see an example of that here in Pittsburgh. We saw last week with the church on the north side, St. Boniface Roman Catholic Church. Again, the circular dome in the center with the side, four side vaults coming into it, cutting into the support underneath it, carving away an opening. Which results in the side vaults, these triangular vaults, which are the pendentive aspect of it, is coming together and concentrating the weight, all this weight above, down to these four points. So this was, although pendentive domes had existed prior, as he illustrated in his lecture in Chicago, showing an example of like the Hagia Sophia that we saw last week, is structured this way. This was this last building that we saw in 1893 was the first time he had constructed that type of a dome. And so he was very proud of it, obviously, and so he was talking about it in his lecture. This one here we're seeing here in Pittsburgh is from 1926. In 1895, he really refined his ability of the thin, what's referred to as a long span dome, and thin structure, just a few layers. This example here being St. John Divine in New York City that we talked about 2 weeks ago. And you can see this great span that's literally comes up, and at the very top, just the three layers of tile. Supporting this. So this very elegant, very thin, almost eggshell in its proportions to span these great distances. He really refined this at this point in 1895 with the St. John Divine, 132 feet across the opening. We have a similar example of that here in Pittsburgh with Buell Planetarium. It's constructed in the same way. Up through here, you can actually see he's got just three layers. The first layer that's laid, the second layer that comes in with the Portland cement between. He then laid what this new innovation here, where he hollowed out a brick. So he's got a 2-inch hollow tile as opposed to the standard 1-inch, in that airspace to create some insulating value. Through the structure. As you can imagine, if this was all solid masonry, the temperature would pass through very quickly in the cold climate outside. So to help try to slow that down, creating some air pockets within the structure. That was an innovation that he developed. Again, what we're talking about here today, this building science of materials and finding new ways to kind of deal with this external, exterior thermal envelope in a masonry condition. A few pictures of the construction of Buell Planetarium. You can see the exterior is a steel structure, and they're starting to set up down at the very base, and then starting to lay in these larger bricks. You see a figure here for scale, working their way up around the sides. Coming up through the center. And then once it's complete, also note from these, so these are photographs that are taken during the construction, kind of to document the work progress and date. This dome was laid up from October 21st to November 18th, So less than a month. Pretty quick. This is an interior shot today. It's been converted to the Children's Museum with a metal mesh dome that's just purely aesthetic, hung from the inside of the mate of Guastavino's work. So to see his work, you almost have to kind of climb up into the catwalks to be able to get to it, which they don't let you do too much.
There's no planetarium anymore?
That it's been moved, but you're right. The previous planetarium was there, which was at the time was pretty monumental as far as its projector and pendulum and these types of things. Is no longer within the dome currently. This is an example in 1899 of a double dome. You can see here the interior dome and exterior dome. So here, what we saw with the Buell Planetarium, where he's putting a little bit of a gap into one of the tiles, he's now making the gap even larger. Again, just to separate the two domes, so that way the exterior dome that protects the building from the elements, the moisture, the heat, the cold, has a little bit more of a buffer from the interior. So in 1899, he's creating this double dome for the first time. And also, I'll point out, you can see this drawing here. This is what's referred to as graphic statics. This is a technique through drawing to be able to calculate the loading that is being transferred on these vaults and transferring that weight down to the ground. And so it's done in a graphic way as opposed to a mathematical calculated way. The way the engineers work today, it's all they'll take the load and quantify it and the dimensions, and they'll use formulas to generate a result to determine what type of materials and structures would be used to support this. Back in Guastavino's day and Antonio Gaudi's day, this was the latest science, was a graphic form where it's projecting these lines, and the length of the lines as well as the angle of the lines is in reference to the result. And so it was a graphic calculation method, which I could spend an entire lecture on trying to explain to you. But just to kind of give you an example that here in this drawing, when he's creating this double dome, he's kind of going back and checking his work to make sure that he's not creating something that's not going to support itself. Then in 1905, he's got a double stack dome. He's taking one dome up on top here, and he's bringing it down and supported by a dome below it. So where we saw in the last example, which was the domes, the two domes were brought down and supported separately to the base. This last example here by dimension is St. Paul's. Up in New York, which is if you recall back the story I told you last lecture about the architect that was teaching at Columbia that kind of discovered all of his drawings. This was the actual vault that he was sitting inside and looking up at the ceiling, noticed this herringbone pattern that gave him the idea of Gaudi's work. But this is the War College, and he's bringing all of the weight down, and he's supporting it directly on the dome below it. Another further innovation, you could see kind of his skill kind of improving as we go through the years. This is 1905. Charles McKim was the architect on this. Then in 1909, you can see here in the drawing, I'm going back to New York here, this flying buttress. And so he's taking some of the load that as his vault is coming down, this vault naturally kind of wants the thrust laterally. And he's taking some of that thrust and he's transferring it out to the side here to this buttressing that we have on the outside, this additional weight that's kind of resisting and pushing back on that weight. You can see it down here, similarly, building up material mass to kind of counteract this thrust. But this flying buttress that we're familiar with in the Gothic, the French, Here we see him doing this in his vaulting technique. You can see kind of the layers of the tiles spanning between the inside and the exterior vault or dome, out in open space, what's referred to as flying. Cross section through that.
These aren't those flat.
What's that?
These are not tomb rolled. Is that the right?
They would be referred to, these vaults, these domes would be referred to as timbrel, yes.
Okay.
But these buttresses are more just like a single arch because they're a single member that's only spanning in one direction as opposed to the dome that's spanning three-dimensionally.
I mean, this is an arch like that, it's more of an arch like that.
That's right. This photograph here is the National Museum of Natural History. The one we saw prior was also, again, St. Paul's. This is in 1907 and 1909. And so in 1910, he's reaching a point where he has amassed quite a collection of domes that he's built around the country. Pretty significant in stature, and so he is taking out an ad to kind of toot his horn of the work that he's doing, again, to garner a reputation from people that are familiar with these structures, recognizing that this is being built by the same individual, but also to attract commissions from the architects he's working with. So we can see, for example, the top here, the largest dome that he's made, which is St. John the Divine in New York. The National Museum in DC. The Science in Brooklyn, New York, the Arts and Sciences. And somewhere in here, there's a couple from Pittsburgh here. Number 11, he's got Rodolf Shalom that we looked at a couple weeks ago. You see just a little bit of it here. Tucked in behind the four-sided dome. And then finally, as he's approaching the teens, 19 teens, the other materials, steel frame as well as concrete, reinforced concrete, is really developing in its own right to where it started to now push back a little bit as far as a competitor for this this brick thin tile that Guastavino is creating, to where even despite this, he's starting to introduce into his patents reinforcing bars here, steel reinforcing within the layers of his brickwork to create kind of like a circular rim around the base. This is to stiffen up the perimeter at the base where you have this kind of lateral thrusting that naturally occurs within a dome structure, as well as at the top. He's bringing these rings up around the top in both directions, as almost as ribs and also in circular. Again, laid in that mortar set between the bricks to reinforce his bricks with some tensile strength that you gain from the steel. So the vaults are not just strictly operating in compression or in a masonry form. These patents were he gained in 1910. And so this brings us back to campus here, the staircase in Baker Hall, which was done in 1914. And so all of these vaults and domes that we just looked at that are kind of developing in complexity and grandeur, this is being done right in that time period, kind of at the tail end of it. And he's creating one of his most dynamic structural forms that he's done anywhere in the world. And we fortunately have it right here in Pittsburgh, and it's the staircase that's supported with inside this octagon form, shape here. And for the way the staircase works, he solves the problem. Even though this diagram is showing a four-sided volume, it works similarly with an octagon form. But he creates an arch that spans from the ground up to the corner. Again, he's fingering into this corner, and then from there he builds on top another one and works your way up. This is a very common technique that's used by the Catalans. That's gone back centuries, and the way that they build their staircases. And so by doing so, as you can see here, this is the simple arch forms that kind of work its way up, kind of fingering around the corners. This can be then laid with these tiles, and these arches extend this down so you get a true arch profile you can see here. And he's taking this down much the same way we saw with the pendentive domes in the structures, the support in the corners, and that works its way up. All of this then creates a staircase that has no support on the interior side, almost like a floating stair visually. So we get this effect here with the Baker Hall staircase. You can see the stair spanning up, working its way around, up. And so this point where the staircase meets the wall and fingers in is really where you get that that action that's happening structurally. Interestingly enough, on the exterior it's an octagon, but on the interior they've laid the brick on the interior where they've rounded the corners, and so he ends up getting more of a circular shape at the perimeter, going back to the vaulting that you get here, more in line with the true circular dome type vault. You can also see the opening being spanned by a simple arch, just a couple, two layers, that then the vault then ties into, that's in the hallway here. Closer up detail, he's treating this almost like a rib that you would get kind of around the perimeter. This is getting laid in against the wall, and then the tile would then fill in to it. And so again, each one of these pieces working from the wall out, he would cut this piece in. For example, he would cut this piece in, lay it in against this side, and then with that, you can lay this piece in where you have now two sides to lay it to. And once that's in place, just work your way out and through it. If we take a look at the drawings, a couple things I wanted to point out here is, so this is a cross section. This is the main entrance to Baker Hall at the end. And you can see the staircase further down as we get to it. Up top, point out in the drawings, the steel structure. So the roof is being supported by a steel frame. But then, as called out here, the timber vault, Hornbostel is calling out in his drawings here at the top. This floor, the upper floor here, the third floor, he's got the Guastavino's vault system that's supporting the floor itself, as well as the ceiling on the underside of it for the main entry here, the vaulted height space. And then as we get down towards the stair, you can see the cross section through here on the second floor, for example. Again, the vaulting system, he's got the span, the timbral arch that's supporting this staircase or the floor system. And then as you work your way up, and you can see the cross section being cut through. In this case, he's showing you a cross section through the staircase. And essentially, this becomes a cantilevering piece. It's supported back here at the wall and by the vault, spanning out to its high point at the edge here. This becomes cantilevering. The only thing that's really kind of providing support at this far end is this rib that carries all the way down the staircase to the floor, to the base level. And so that rib is like this continual spiral that works its way up to support the interior side of that cantilever. A little bit closer in here to see it. So it's, as you can imagine, the spiraling shape is quite sophisticated from a structural standpoint, what he's creating here. Also of note, not just the floor, but the sides, Guastavino tile selected. He's providing the tile work on the sides, so this entire railing is created out of his tile work. And then he's also got cement treads for here, but he's also got tile risers. So that's the face of the risers are, he created a custom glazed tile for visual appeal. And then this is, again, just another section through the staircase where you see the same thing. It's the, it's cantilevering out from the wall, being supported by this continuous rib that goes up along the edge, spiraling its way up the four floors. And then also on his exterior elevation, interestingly enough, you can see the exterior wall, the window, and you can see the staircase passing by the window. And he's calling out for an iron fascia on the stringer of the stair as a decorative element that would then be seen through the windows from the exterior, kind of showcasing that that staircase that's kind of floating past the stair, past the window. Wanted to play a quick video just to give you a little bit better sense, if you haven't seen the staircase, of the shape of it.
I think the son was around when this was being put together.
So this was actually built by his son. Guastavino Sr. had passed away by this point. This was in 1914. Sr. passed away in 1908. So his son, who wasn't trained in a school but was trained as an apprentice under his father, turns out to be far more daring and accomplished in his structure. He was the one that built the large dome over St. John the Divine in New York. That was by the son, not Senior. You can see here three layers of this rib that goes down through the center is just three layers of tile that is just traditional detail for this technique. And you can kind of get a sense of the way that this rib kind of spirals up. And then these tiles are herringboned into that rib. You see the raised mortar, which we'll be getting into next week a little bit more. So this is the tile itself in a terracotta, unglazed, raised mortar joint is classic Guastavino work. And so we're really fortunate to have really probably his most crowning achievement is from a structural perspective right here in Pittsburgh. Not only does the staircase goes up to a vault over the main hall here, again, coming down to four points. And I think we'll see here in this second segment, the oculus at the very top that's elliptical in shape, a little bit more complex than a standard circle. We talked about a little bit last week, that ellipse that was kind of defined by Hornbostel. He drew out the actual profile and shape, so it was a question of Guastavino just kind of following his direction. Which we saw in the drawings here, and you can see here through looking up through it, just the complexity of this tile that's being laid up. But the cross sections, the elevations that we just looked at, although these drawings are by Hornbostel, and he's really showing exactly what he wants as far as showing the elevations of these stairs, the specifics of how that gets built is all on Guastavino's shoulders. He's the, as all of these architects do, they kind of draw the section and they just put an arrow to it, say Guastavino vault. And that the detailing and the know-how of putting it together comes back to the trade. You can see here these arches coming back to the corners, supporting it, like this vault here in the hall, as well as out to the main entry, which we'll see more of next week. And there's actually a spot you might be interested in. If you go down to the basement here where it terminates, there's a spot right up in here on the ceiling where there's a little hole about this size, and they've broken away the tile just to see what was underneath it to try to take some samples and to study the mortar and the subsequent layers, which you can't see on the surface without kind of like getting into that kind of deconstruction. So getting a little bit more to the building science side of it, away from the structure, here we're seeing in 1894, an example of this innovation that he had with exterior weatherproofing, trying to create tile that can hold up to the exterior elements.
In 1889, Vanderbilt, George Washington Vanderbilt II, commissioned Richard Hunt to create the largest private home in America, set on 8,000 acres, which was the acreage which was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, the designer of Central Park in New York City, as well as the Chicago World's Fair, was also laid out by Olmsted. And so in designing this house, Guastavino was brought in to create these exterior vaults in the loggia on the exterior of the house to create a material that could hold up to the elements, the heat, the humidity, the moisture. And so this was a way to kind of market his tile to this effect. And by once he laid up the loggia, they brought him inside the house and asked him to tile the ceiling and the walls of their indoor pool. Again, subject to all this humidity from the water in the pool, and so it has to have a material that can hold up to the same type of abuse that you would have on the exterior of the house. And so this was created by Guastavino at that time period. And so if we work our way back to Pittsburgh, at this same time period, we have, again, these industrialists that find themselves in Pittsburgh during this Renaissance that we're having. And they, a few of them, having seen the pool that Vanderbilt was working on, decided to create their own pool here in Pittsburgh, which was the Phipps Natatorium in 1908. And this was developed, and you can see here the tile work is a little bit more decorative than what we saw in Vanderbilt's. Again, trying to kind of maybe upstage and do one better. This is no longer intact, but from this pool that we had in at the public pool, by also, I'll side note here, in 1907, for a quarter, you could get into the pool for a day, which was essentially, at that time period, was more like a bath. But it was a public pool, which was also quite innovative in its time. But this brought about in 1910, by the architect Jansen, was commissioned to design a similar indoor pool for the Pittsburgh Athletic Club. Athletic Association in Oakland, which we're seeing here. And actually at the time that I took these photographs, which was a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, this pool was under renovation, being converted to an office type development. But in that process, the decision was made to try to preserve Guastavino's tiles that were there, seeing them as a feature to the space. And so you have not only the tile work, the vaults and the ribs that we're seeing, but also the terracotta around the perimeter of the balcony that overlooks the pool, as well as the rib or the striped tiles on the walls. So a question was asked a couple weeks ago about whether anyone's kind of building these, doing this type of work today. Most of the work that happens today is usually restoration like this, where they have a vault structure that had been not used for a period of time, and so it's kind of in disarray. And so the contractor here actually is going back and they're actually cleaning the tiles from the dirt and debris. You can see here an example of before and after of the tile work to try to get them kind of brought back to their original luster. And as you can also imagine, would be quite tedious, especially with the this kind of ribbed texture of the tile, which we're going to get into a lot more next week. And you can also see examples of where this raised mortar had fallen out. So the know-how of how to kind of rebuild some of this stuff is really the extent of what gets done, which is not a whole lot, as you can imagine. There's a cutaway,
And also, one point, like when you have these structures where, that are being repaired or in disarray, is kind of the rare moments when you can actually get inside, see inside. So here you can see a stamp of one of the brick tiles that was laid. Each one of these bricks would be stamped and inventoried so they could track when these bricks were made, when the orders were placed. And all of these kind of, all this information, Guastavino happened to be very organized in keeping this archive of all of these details. And so not just the structures, but also you could go back with these lots and you could find out when was this made, where was this made, how was it made. All those details and specs are kept.
Could you go back two slides real quick just for a clarification? A little bit more for the, show the floor. More, sorry. The floor is the pool.
Right, the pool's down here.
Clearly.
Right.
Yeah, so they filled in the pool.
So with the Pittsburgh Athletic Association have their own indoor pool. The Mellons wanted their own private indoor pool. And I guess Mrs. Mellon didn't want to swim with the other members of the club. The club being a little more exclusive than the public pool from Phipps downtown, became private club and then now private residence. So we see here this addition that was put on the Mellon house to house an indoor pool. And this was done, of course, as you can imagine, by Guastavino. The Mellon residence in 1917. Here the tiles are white and in off-white tones. Quite stunning. The side windows, circular, that kind of are brought into the space. And this, in this case, the white tile was used, which we're seeing here, not only for it glazed to protect it from the moisture and humidity of the pool, but also with these side windows to bring the light, as you see, reflecting off of the windows coming in to try to carry the natural light through the room to illuminate the space. So here he's also looking and he's studying the light aspect to the space. You can see the light reflecting across the surface. Even creating different types of shadow effects with the way the tiles are laid. We'll get into that a little bit more next week. And also just looking at a solid piece versus striated, which this creating much more light carrying across, crackling effect in the tile. That was intentional for a surface. And so here you can really see with the lights off, the artificial lights, the natural light coming in, carried across the room, and you can see it working its way across the surface to illuminate the space. This obviously being converted to a classroom, or a at one point it was a for the boardroom, exactly. But the pool was down here below in its initial.
I took life-saving in that pool.
Oh, nice.
Where is that?
Chatham.
Chatham, on Chatham's campus. So in 1900, the Guastavino company created this standard tile factory up in Boston. And we're seeing here the entryway into their factory. And you can see him showing off different types of tiles, glazes for when he brings in an architect or a developer that wants to see how the tiles are made. He's kind of showing off his wares again and creating kind of this signature standardized brick. You can see here with his name to try to get more control over the end product. Because prior to this, he was buying all of his bricks to order. From various types of manufacturers, usually nearby to the site of the structures that's going up. You can see the exterior of it here, drawing, kind of showcasing the different types of elements.
And then by this point, these are some of these standard bricks that he's making. So these bricks were made by Guastavino's company in Boston. And you can kind of see the difference, or you can see the standardization that's coming. These grooves that traditionally are used in a brick from as a structural element just to create more surface for the mortar to bind to as you do these laminations. Here it's become more of an aesthetic, which we'll get into more detail next week. But you can see from this example here of the Association's pool and then the Mellon's pool, the very standardized brick, each unit almost identical one to the next, that he's able to create from his own manufacturing. He also then gets into acoustics. So here he's dealing with thermal, light, and now acoustics. The tiles, as you can imagine, are very lively and loud. Not a whole lot of place for the sound to deaden. And so in certain spaces, certain conditions, you don't want that loud noise. So he's trying to figure out ways to try to reduce that noise. In this case, he's developed a patent for a certain type of clay that he's creating to create a more porous surface, with the thought that that these openings within the surface would then trap the sound, keep it from reverberating off a more finished, polished surface. His first use of this was in this what's referred to as this Rumford tile, this first patent that he creates. And you can see this tile itself, the surface and texture of it has this more kind of a porous surface as opposed to the smooth surface we just saw at the Mellon pool. And this develops to a second iteration, what's referred to as the Acoustolith tile. And the Acoustolith tile is also patented. And this tile, we can see examples of that here in Pittsburgh in the Cathedral of Learning. So the structure, obviously, a Gothic style, which we saw much of last week in the religious structures. But the tile itself, as we get a little bit closer up to the ribs that he's also creating, in addition to the vaulting between them. As well as the aisle around the perimeter. And here you can see a little bit closer up, you can see the texture of it being much more porous on the surface. And as you walk through places like the Cathedral Learning here, this acoustic tile is used in quite a few structures around Pittsburgh. But as you walk through these spaces, you can perceive audibly the deadening of the sound as you walk through these aisles as opposed to coming out in the larger, grander space. Here's a little bit closer up detail of the porous nature of it. Also point out, happened to notice when I was taking this, a crack that has developed within the one area. And generally cracks occur when you have movement in the structure, support, the foundation. But interesting to notice the way the crack kind of moves through the structure here. You can see kind of starting at this point at a joint between these two cast piece. It follows this mortar joint along here, and then it cuts through the tile, follows the joint, cuts through the tile. And so as it cuts through the tile, most cases it's cutting through the tile. Occasionally it'll follow the mortar. But this is kind of typical of Guastavino's work in that the mortar set that he used was so adhesive that the resistance, whenever you have something that the stress is being placed, more often than not, the tile itself would fail before the actual mortar would fail, because the stress that's being relieved is gonna fracture across that tile as opposed to across the mortar. And generally, in a masonry structure, you find that the cracks kind of following the mortar joint, and you kind of do this type of thing. So this is kind of a signature of Guastavino's work. Kind of speaks to the strength of this Portland cement that he spent quite a bit of money to import from England to get the most premium mortar set he could find. This is one of my favorite spots in the cathedral. As you go up these little stairs here, kind of circle in the center, up in here. And what's great about it is you can get up close to the ceiling because it's low. And not only do you have this amazing like column in the center that kind of splays out, creates kind of inverse vault here to support the structure, but you can also get up close to it where you can not only touch and feel the surface of this, but this tile, but also acoustically, as you walk up past through here, the sound just deadens to the point where you get almost complete silence. A closer view of it here. So that wraps it up for today. Next week we'll get into his innovations in his decorative innovations, more aesthetics. To the tile surfaces, and kind of continue from there. Thanks.
Thank you.